Welcome to the Reaction Podcast. I'm Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor. I'm joined by Ian Martin, Editor of Reaction. If you like what you hear, please do go to our website at www.reaction.life and you can subscribe to read all the great writing on there. So this week we're going to try and sort of combat the, I think, general feeling of depression. Me and Ian were talking about how paradoxically, with the opening, there's this, everyone's feeling a bit down, and try and keep it quite upbeat. So Ian, in that light, take us through, from your perspective, what the government is doing at the moment, what the plan is, if any, you know, what are the big ideas driving policy and number 10 at the moment?
Yeah, well, that's, thanks for that setup there. I'll try and keep it as upbeat as possible. There is just an outside, as we're recording this, there's an ice cream van going past. So that gives things a more kind of optimistic feel. The warm weather will come back. There's no point shying away from it. Is there? I mean, pretty much everyone I encounter at the moment is really struggling with this, because I think there was a feeling that we had in January, February, the height of the second wave, when things were really terrible, but vaccination was taking off, and you could see forward to about now, just around Easter. You had a glimmer of the possibility of Easter being a bit more normal, and things have become more complicated again since then. I think what is happening, and this is made difficult to read by the fact that the government's communication strategy, while vastly superior to its strategy, say, a year ago, and they're better organized, they're not communicating as clearly as they might be, I think, or actually explaining to people really what's going on. So you're having to try and divine this by, as a journalist, speaking to various people and thinking about it. And what I think is happening is that the based on what I hear, is that the supply problem on, or supply complications on, vaccine delivery mean that there are some time lags. We're obviously seeing that with it slowing up. There's the AZ component to that as well. With this week, we'll talk about AZ, and you've got a very particular take on that, Alistair. So that complicates things. They are behind the scenes clearly working like mad with the pharma industry to boost British domestic capacity on manufacturing and on finishing. And we saw this week, Moderna coming on. So other vaccines are coming on as well. But there's a bit of a lag there, and a slowing after the enormous progress that's been made in the first few months of the year. And in that space, I think they're then worried about an unknown unknown, as Donald Rumsfeld would have put it during the Iraq War, which is what's happening in South America and the concern over variants. So I think it, their caution, and Boris, of course, is announced on Monday that he's sticking to the roadmap, but I thought in not a particularly convincing or reassuring way, that I think their concern must be that in what's left of April and then in May, you get some surge. Just keep talking about the third wave, based on variants and a lag in the vaccine program, which combines to make the reopening on May the 17th and then later in June more complicated and less certain than it was. That's not what the government is saying. That's my reading of it. So I think that's where they are at the moment. And that must feed into the public mood and morale. People can sense that things are not going quite as planned. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I think it was quite possible to sort of park COVID over the last couple of months in the "it's been bureaucratized" bit of my brain. The rollouts. It was sort of fun watching the rollouts speed up, occasional bump in the roads followed by you know, dramatic increases. I think there's obviously still an overwhelmingly positive story to be told there. We have virtually vaccinated everyone below the age of 60 who is, you know, in these at-risk categories. Even people I know who I don't particularly think were at risk, they just happen to have a, you know, they're healthy, they just happen to have a condition on their NHS health record which puts them in that bracket. You know, so it shows that it's covering a lot of people who would, you know, even face quite small risks. And then everyone over the age of 50 virtually has been offered first dose. And, you know, we wouldn't be arguing, I think, about COVID, or we would be arguing about it in the same terms as swine flu if we were just looking at an epidemic below the age of 50, because it is so, the disease is very rare complications for people at the age of 50. It's just a fact. You look at the figures. You say I have a particular view on the AZ decision. The MHRA yesterday didn't ban its use in under 30s. It merely recommended that if there is another vaccine available, then they should go for that. So it was a bit more nuanced than how it was reported. But I thought it was perfectly sensible decision. We will have so many more vaccines available in the medium term, some of which may have a better safety profile among young people. You don't have to subscribe all the time. I think there are commentators now who just are so invested in this idea that it's a people's war against the virus, and that to borrow the term from the Chinese state, that you know, that any setback or uncertainty about take up of vaccines is somehow not sort of getting involved in the national effort, and people should be thrilled to be part of this. And okay, fine, that's all great, but you know, you need to understand that a lot of this stuff is about personal risk as well, you know. And I think there are plenty of good public health reasons for not being super gung-ho about this stuff. And those reasons were more compelling in favor of being bold maybe 2 months ago when the virus was absolutely running rampant, but it isn't. It's basically at very low levels now. And, you know, coming
You make the Kate Bingham point, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So if you actually listen to what Kate Bingham said into reaction in her appearance on the Answer Time program, which was a fascinating one with her and Brian Cox, I think, involved. She upstaged Brian Cox, which was pretty amazing and on the science side of things. But she said, you know, the main goal in the vaccine procurement and the vaccine strategy at the start was, how do we stop all this death happening? And she said that was the first motivator in terms of the thinking of the procurement for some of these vaccines. Now, the AstraZeneca vaccine is, you know, clearly working really well in stopping old people die of this disease. It may not necessarily be the best vaccine in the long term, which is why the government, by the way, has bought loads and loads of different vaccines, one of which is the Valneva vaccine, which is I think the terminology is inactivated virus. Now, that's the same technology that's used in many, many vaccines that we take in general, like the hepatitis B one, for example. And that technology has been around for a long time. That may have a much better safety profile in the long term. I mean, that's why the government has bought 250 million doses of the thing. So I think there's this real, I think, terrible mental disease, I think, with the commentary on this, that everything has to be about comms and, you know, what you're communicating to people and, you know, and about national mission. I saw a journalist at Politico genuinely tweet yesterday that, oh, shouldn't the EMA, the European Medicines Agency, have joined up their comms with the MHRA in the UK, because it looked strange them saying slightly different things about the AZ vaccine. You're just like, okay, you know, roll back a bit. These people don't have a responsibility to make your life as a journalist slightly easier, or for they don't have a responsibility either for, you know, different health agencies, which have maybe a different approach or a different culture, and just have a and the disease is in very different places. Europe is going through a terrible epidemic, almost new epidemic of coronavirus. We have basically passed it. You know, these things are moving all the time, I'm the first person to say that there is no one consensus on the science in coronavirus, because it touches on so many domains and so many parts of human life, especially some of the things we've done in terms of social distancing. But on some of these decisions, which are basically highly technical and pretty, you know, to do with scientific expertise, then 100% you can take the decision making on that basis, and you don't have to have these kind of broad arguments about what it means for sociology and, you know, the humanities and all that stuff, which is important to get into. But on this sort of issue, I mean, it's not the same.
What do you think people should make of the stuff that's happening in Brazil and Chile, which is obviously the backdrop to what I was describing, which is the government's concern? I think, you know, I don't think it is the conspiracy thing that the government really doesn't want to give up control. I mean, I have major, we'll come to vaccine passports and stuff in a moment, but I do detect that it's genuine, that they're looking at South America and thinking, can we get a handle on what's happening here? How should we read all of that? And of course the numbers in Brazil are terrible, and people are obsessed with this thing, you know, the P1 variant and transmissibility, and it's obviously in other parts of the world, and it's in Britain and it's in Ireland. So how should we think about that?
So there are two really interesting questions. I think there are two ways of thinking about it that I understand. Now, in government, I get the sense that the variants are the next new narrative in the COVID crisis. Now, there are good reasons to say that they will be important. Like, what does the virus do in a world where people overwhelmingly have antibodies to it? Well, it might change in some ways to find new hosts to infect, which is, by the way, why we have a vaccine strategy with vaccines which take on other bits of the coronavirus beyond the spike protein, which is what the sort of first generation ones will go after, I think, especially the mRNA ones. What happens next? And I think we have to be careful overindulging that this is the next great sort of twist in the tail, and it's going to come back. Because, you know, you look at, so the Pfizer vaccine, and we were all really worried about the South Africa variant. The Pfizer vaccine on a large scale has proved really resilient against the South African variant over time. In Brazil, the reporting is pretty insane, I think. Sometimes people say, oh, it's a whole new thing, and younger people are now conking it on the streets, and it's all this hellhole. Well, you know, you have to be careful about how you interpret a lot of the data coming out of health services in Brazil. I mean, I saw yesterday a tweet being like, it is, you know, stating as a fact, more young people are in ICU now because it's the, and saying that that's the property of the virus. It's intrinsically more virulent for young people. Well, no, there are many reasons why there could be more young people in hospitals. One, because, you know, and more people dying because health, you know, clearly in Brazil, health capacity, all these hospitals are in total crisis and people are not getting access to the best care. Two, that you have to think about how these things are triaged, how they treat it in Brazil, who is now being prioritized for ICU. So there are loads and loads of issues here that people need to be very careful about making big judgments about. And that's not to say they're not serious and potentially really worrying, but, you know, it's the same with the Chile one. The narrative is, oh, even if you vaccinate huge proportions of the population, it's still going to come back and bite you in the ass. Well, okay, there is nuance. They've used a Chinese vaccine which has really variable performance in trials, and also apparently really needs, I mean, I read somewhere that it's the booster shot that really makes it effective, not even the first shots or something. That may be untrue. But again, you have to nuance it. And I think there is a danger with government of over sort of living this variant narrative and saying, you know, and all their energies are about thinking about the variants and kind of it's a one-eyed thing. You know, if people end up getting a cold style symptoms, even after they've had the virus or maybe getting a bit ill but not dying, this is not a public health crisis. This is people just getting ill of a disease that has reinfected them again after time. And, you know, but it's we'll, good, have, but it's good. We'll have a booster yeah. shot, we'll have by winter time, we'll be well prepared for all this stuff. And I think there's, you know, it's all worrying, but you just, when you sort of sit with it and over time, the narrative sort of weakens and weakens until you think, okay, well, it was initially very worrying, but now you look at it and think, well, it's sort of a bit worrying. And now, you know, it's a bit like with the new strain here. There was this huge palaver saying it's 30% more lethal, briefed out by Neil Ferguson's Robert Peston. I mean, you know, why was that? Why did that happen? It's to create a media. It's spin. It's a media narrative. The variant is not just more transmissible. It's going to kill you. It's more likely to kill you. That's a terrifying idea. And it, you know, 2 months down the line, the data comes out and you realize, okay, it wasn't, you know, this is the data from Public Health England, wasn't actually more lethal. It might have been more likely to put you in hospital. Again, you know, various reasons why more people might have gone to hospital at a time of year. It's winter time, horrible weather, no vitamin D. People get ill from respiratory viruses, et cetera, et cetera. And then you look past the spin, you think, well, it was a serious thing, but it wasn't the apocalypse. And I think that's what I think. Again, comes to my final point is the politics of emergency can be employed to repeatedly to talk about these threats. But at some point you have to say, okay, well, we've really gone round the ringer with this kind of way of talking about what's going on. Let's try and work out maybe a different language and a different way of thinking about it. And to be fair to Chris Whitty, for example, he has really come out in the last few weeks. If you actually look at what he's saying, he's making a very strong argument saying, you know, coronavirus is going to be with us. It may kill people next winter, but we have to have a conversation about what mortality we're prepared to tolerate from this disease, as we do with flu and we've done for many years. And you know, he said 2 years ago, was it 10,000 people died of flu in this country, and it didn't, you know, we didn't have any conversations about how we were going to stop that happening. Now,
the risk might have changed,
but we need to have that conversation.
But I've been struck by that as well, the way in which Whitty and Valance and Van Tam and his communications, the way in which they're sort of they're re-emerging as people prepare to be a bit more kind of realistic, weirdly, about the trade-offs. The thing that frightens me at the moment is the politics, where we don't have politics in the conventional sense, and we don't have a parliament. So we're deciding, we haven't really had a functioning parliament for a year. And we're kind of deciding, or it's just happening, as a function of a crisis just sort of stretching on, that we don't have politics practiced and mediated as normal. And that, I find that terrifying in itself. And the way in which, but more terrifying than that, is the way in which for most people that seems to be absolutely fine. Yeah. So if you look at the polling and how relaxed people are about that, and they're just the way they sort of accept emergency measures and accept that this is going to roll on longer than the scientists say, because the politicians are worried about the consequences of releasing too early. But I noticed this on social media whenever I say, and it's from otherwise reasonable, intelligent people, and I say we don't really have a parliament. You know, a reaction reader responded to me the other day, well, this is probably a good thing. It's just like every other business. They should learn to work on Zoom and that means they can be closer to their constituents and helping their constituents, which is their job, which is a complete misunderstanding from an otherwise intelligent person about what politics is and what the role of Parliament is. Parliament is us. Mm. Parliament is our primary defence, theoretically, against the executive. It sits above the executive. It's not a sort of incidental annoyance, or shouldn't be, that the executive uses when it needs to get its speeches cheered and its measures through. It's there to interrogate and hold to account. The executive reports to Parliament. That's the theory. And that's stopped happening, and three quarters of the country seems to not really care about that. Or maybe this is a legacy of, as a reaction writer pointed out to me, and just Parliament becoming so intrinsically unpopular, almost as unpopular as the media. And that goes back to the expenses crisis and various scandals. And people have so little faith in it that they're just happy to have government by press conference and polling and the Prime Minister popping up once in a while, telling us when we can go out, when we can go into our parents' homes and have a cup of tea with them, which is now, well, God knows when that's going to happen. But is this shift in public opinion, which was maybe always there, a kind of latent authoritarianism or high susceptibility to authoritarianism, which is the settled view of about, as I say, about 70% of the country. My concern is, though, the longer this goes on, and this feeds back into what we were talking earlier about how depressed people are, how widespread this sort of anxiety and low national mood is that the two are connected. The fact that you don't have a politics and that you don't have a sort of lively national conversation is a function of the deadening of culture, which is what the crisis is doing to people. It's not just in politics. It's there in media. It's there in the arts. Everything is. Have you noticed how people are sort of bored of the news, but they can't even really get that interested in cheering themselves up with culture either, because there isn't the freshness or the interplay that comes from going to see a play or walking absentmindedly into a gallery or going properly to a football match or meeting people in a pub. All of that stuff, which sparks human interest and interaction, isn't happening. So you end up with this sort of very kind of postmodern, drone-ish culture where life is kind of okay. And it's certainly okay for the middle classes. It's kind of fine. Pretty terrible for large parts of the working class living halfway up a tower block, as we've discussed before. But there's then the added complication that there isn't really any opposition to this either. So there's no. I feel it's kind of deadened culture, flattened politics, and. I want people to wake up from it. I wrote for the Times about the young in defense of the young. You see some signs, which I think it's extraordinary what the young are putting up with and now having to be lectured about litter and potential misbehavior in schools and all the rest of it from the education secretary. You see some signs of hope. You think people are, in your generation, are starting to wake up to this. Am I being too gloomy?
No, I think people have noticed. People who I think were previously naive, which is a nice way of putting it, is sort of naive about what was actually happening. It's an emergency and we're going to put up with this because otherwise. Granny and grandpa might die and we've got to make this sacrifice and then once they're all vaccinated and protected, then things will quote unquote go back to normal. Now, there are obviously very good reasons for thinking why that might be true, but I always thought throughout the whole thing that that was really missing the point in a sense. And there were much profounder things going on in our politics, much more disturbing things happening in terms of the way certain trends have been accelerated by the crisis. Trends which were by no means written in stone and were reversible with changes in politics, with everything. You know, I think there's this real element now where, and it's what you've addressed there, that thickening sense of sameness is infecting people's perceptions of lots of things. The polling about what we should do about coronavirus is no longer seen to be a useless aid to how people feel, given that it's an emergency and polling is likely to reflect personal sense of insecurity and government messaging. It's now taken to sort of mean, well, the settled will of what people just think is a reasonable thing to happen. It's not true. Polling shows you only one part of the picture. So, you know, there is this sort of thickening sense of what's the alternative. And I think Keir Starmer and the Labour Party really have to think about what they've done over the last year and the lack of political imagination involved in just at every stage calling for what the government was doing to be done harder and faster and more aggressively. I mean, I just wonder whether there's enough people in that room or in there. I'm sure they're all clever people. There's enough people saying, if anything has taught us, if politics of the last 10, 15 years has taught us anything, it's that anyone who has a bit of vim about them and dedication and eloquence and personal charisma, then you can argue for lots of stuff which was seen to be unconventional, unorthodox, out of the mainstream. And emergency or no emergency, that's still true. You know, that's what politics is. It's about imagination and arguing for what you believe in. And I think with Starmer, now he's clearly worried that the public's perception of him is that he's just a bit of a turncoat and just says what Boris says. And that's what I think has actually prompted his kind of change of messaging on stuff like vaccine passports. It's not suddenly that the principles have changed. It's that he's been presented with polling that says, well, people think you're a pretty shady guy who just hasn't got any principles. You know, I think I did see some polling about that a couple of weeks ago and it was reported on. And, you know, hey presto, suddenly there's we couldn't possibly do that. It's un-British, blah, blah, blah. So I think among young people, there's several problems, and it's been around for a while. And I'm going to write about this for my column this week on Reaction. Is that, you know, a couple of years ago, Dave Runciman made the slightly glib suggestion of expanding voting. He's a political scientist. Expanding voting rights to 6-year-olds on the basis that if you can read, you can vote, and that there are some old people who do vote who are not really compos mentis. You know, it's not that they shouldn't vote; it's that they absolutely should vote. But that with the changes in demographics in this country and in lots of Western countries, there's always going to be a super majority for people over the age of basically middle-aged people and old people, and what. 100 years ago, posh university educated elite politicians were scared of the young mob. Young societies are more aggressive, you know, they're perceived to be more ignorant in general in the era before mass education. And what mass democracy does is it gives all these, you know, young, aggressive people, sometimes ignorant people, a voice, and the elites have to respond to it. Now we're in a sort of different position now. The mass of people is old. And that implies a completely different approach to politics. And he made actually a very good point that the Brexit coalition, who were overwhelmingly it's one of the most important signifiers of whether you voted Brexit or not was whether you went to university or didn't. Now the people in Parliament, it's something like 90% of people in Parliament went to university. not true of the country. It's about 45% of the country. So lots of people who felt that their voices were not represented in this Remainery, soft liberal parliament, and used that vote where they had representation and one vote each to say, well, we had not quite enough of that and we want to change course. And that was definitely part of the Brexit debate. But yeah, with the young, that you can't really do that because there aren't enough of you. And it is a bit of a first. It is a bit of a first world problem. And you know, I'm sticking up for people who, I think, millennials either get pigeonholed as sort of phone addicted morons, or people, or there's the millennials who sort of spend their time rubbishing other millennials and say, "Oh, well, I'm different." But you know, it's not great being under the age of 40 in this country for a variety of reasons, even if you're pretty well off, and that. It makes all the kind of conservative ideas of the, you know, society is a contract between the living and the unborn and the, you know, and the past and all that sound a bit glib sometimes, because you're just like, well, everyone over the age of 50 is just having a grand time and won't see to live all the consequences of a lot of politics, you know, long-term consequences like climate change or, you know, the huge changes in technology and, you know, the changes in the way states operate and, you know, all that stuff.
I think that generation get, I think it's more than just the economics. I think that they're stitched up by my generation and older generations. It's not just about house prices, though. I think the economics is, there should be much more focused on that and a rebalancing towards the young, which won't happen because if you look at where the Conservative Party's coalition of interests is in England, it's with older voters and it's worrying about the red wall and all the rest of it. But I think that generation also have been stitched up by the postmodernists and by the sort of fed a diet of kind of social justice grievance and a politics on, I think BLM is a function of it as well, or an example of it, and the extreme rhetoric on climate change, which is obviously a serious problem and needs to be dealt with, and conservatives should think seriously about conservation and the environment. Of course, I'm not a denialist on this, but if you no wonder that generation is pretty risk averse and terrified if fed a diet of we're all going to fry in the great climate emergency, for which we only have hours, days to complete, unless we completely redesign the global economy and end capitalism in its current format. You're all going to fry by 2030, 2040. It's not a useful or intelligent way to think about things. And I think it's unnecessarily alarmist, and the same on the kind of social justice thing, which is you must feel guilt. You must feel guilt about everything, which whether it's race, class, privilege, advantage of any sort, your parents. So guilt is ladled on, I feel sorry for that generation. What I hoped would come out of the crisis is actually a rethink or a focus or a waking up and realizing that actually on the core economic stuff, that's where, and civil liberties, that's where I think the young should be focusing their energies. And I would love it if your generation just got stuck into taking over some organizations like Liberty, or I know Big Brother Watch is fundraising at the moment, and various other organizations. So there is a stirring there. I find it extraordinary but unsurprising, considering what we've been through in this crisis, that my generation and older are actually now seriously, actively contemplating vaccine passports domestically, which is an enormous incursion and a complete change in the social contract, in a situation where we're all going to have been vaccinated and can prove it, but in which the rollout is slowing for those under 50 and will take ages to get to those under 30, but you'll still have to have your vaccine passport stamping you as unclean and unvaccinated, but then you'll have to test yourself and prove it so that you and I can go to the theater in, you know, 2 or 3 months time, or, you know, or your parents can take you to the, take you to a concert. It's just, I find this extraordinary that my generation is even contemplating this, but is going to get away with it because of what we talked about earlier, the polling. On the polling thing, just two very quick points before we wrap up. We were going to talk about Scotland, but let's save Scotland and let's do a Scotland special, because that's just depressing on a whole other level. So let's sort of spare reaction listeners Scotland this week. On Starmer, just briefly to defend him, not something I'm necessarily prone to do, but I think the scale of the disaster that he inherited and the enormity of the rebuilding operation that needs to take place, how trashed the Labour brand was on basic questions like patriotism, do you like your country, can you trust these people to be in charge of mainstream institutions or not. What Corbyn wrought, the disaster, means that he's coming from such a long way back that it's really, really difficult. I think the obsession with the polling thing, which now this government just polls on an almost comically extensive level, just polls absolutely everything and thinks and looks in the runes for some kind of truth about where the public are, which is Boris's obsession. He sees wisdom in the crowd, and it's all very... He sees wisdom, and he also sees a threat from the crowd or from the mob. It's all very Roman, and he's a Roman figure, a kind of pre-Christian figure. The problem with polling is, and some of my best friends are pollsters or use polling quite a lot, but is it cannot give you foresight. It cannot really tell you what to think, or how to make sensible decisions. It's really interesting. It's very useful. It's part of the toolkit for public life, but it isn't the answer. If it was the answer, if in 1938, when polling was in its infancy and didn't really feature at all, if you had polled the British public on appeasement and attitudes to the dictatorships and attitudes to fascism at the height of the crisis in 1938, well, it's not that difficult to work out what the answers would have told you. And fast forward 2 years later, and also what they would have told you in 1938 about attitudes to Winston Churchill and what he'd been saying for the previous 3 or 4 years about Nazi Germany. Well, you know, go two years beyond that to May and June 1940, public attitudes would be completely, completely different. But if politicians guide themselves by reading those runes and thinking that there is some fundamental truth in there, the wisdom of the crowd, and give up on the idea that actually democracy is much more complex than that, that it's about the interplay between a range of different types of institutions, public opinion, democracy expressed in regular elections, but it all mediated in a complex, constant flow of conversation and decision making and testing, then that you end up with what we have now, unfortunately.
I think that just quickly to sort of round off, I think people need to be very careful what they wish for. I think with some of this stuff about, as you say, this appetite for security and this perception that's kind of heralding the sort of biosecurity state as just the model that we live with, and the model which sets the terms in which we talk about politics and kind of defines sort of fruitfully the way we think about politics. Now, all that stuff might turn out to be wonderfully brilliant in 20 years' time. We might, though, find out that our real problem was not that, you know, we might, one, be preparing for the wrong threat, and that the real threat is we actually become a society like Italy or Japan. Japan, the hirikori, you know, isolated society among young people, which they, I mean, I love Italy, I love Japan. They are stagnant societies. You know, they're really aging. Their young population, especially Italy, the young population has been completely screwed over in the last decade. You know, just devastating. And, you know, and Brexiteers were the first to talk about that during the Eurozone crisis, and just the way that the Mediterranean, so, you know, I remember reading Robert Toombs' new book. He speaks eloquently about what happened in the Mediterranean states and the way young people were basically sacrificed in a big way for the European project. And, you know, we will, that's what will happen in this country if we continually bar and create obstacles for particularly people under the age of 40 to live fruitfully in this country, to ply their trades, to you know, maybe a naff word, but innovate and, you know, and come up with the future.
That's the great explosion which happens post-war in this country. It's one of the, you know, most positive aspects of British history and the recent British experience, is that surge of energy, which now, of course, there are elements of youth culture in the 1960s and 1970s, which are inherently ridiculous. And, you know, a lot of the intellectualism of that period is inherently ridiculous. But alongside all of that, much more importantly, is just this surge of social mobility driven by meritocratic ideas and a surge of youthful culture, interest in the outside world, whether it's, you know, jazz coming from the US or blues and rock and roll, cinema, fashion, an explosion, and just this wonderful flowering of working class culture, and a rediscovery in the 60s at the heart of it, right in the middle of it, that English culture and British culture has value and has something intrinsically worth celebrating, and not everything should be about the imitation of of American modernity. And that that's the spirit that animates Revolver and animates Sergeant Pepper. So that's about a surge of youthfulness and exciting thinking, which just spreads out across society in the rise of the new, much bigger middle class, which travels, which gets to see the world. And of course, those are now the older voters. And I think we've got to be careful and make, you know, I wrote about this for the Times, and it's difficult in 950 words always to try and capture this, but it's not as though older Britain, boomer Britain, or Britain in its 70s or 80s now just takes one fixed view of the young. I know a lot of older voters will be as worried about this as you are, as I am, as a middle-aged person. But I think you make a very good point about society sort of atrophying or becoming culturally stagnant if we lose that. Listen, we're going to wrap up there this week. If you're not a Reaction subscriber, as Alistair said earlier, go to the site www.reaction.life. You get my weekly newsletter, you get Alistair's column, you get writing from Maggie Pagano and all the rest of the team and our columnists, Tim Marshall, great foreign affairs expert and geopolitical writer, now writes a weekly column, and lots of other great columnists all week. So become a Reaction subscriber, and thank you for listening to the Reaction podcast. We'll be back next week.